Hello everyone. Many of the stories you're about to hear are from The Men Who Made Manchester United, the book inspired by this podcast released in October 2023. It's available to order now on Waterstones, Amazon and in many other places. And it basically gives you the definitive history of Manchester United before Sir Matt Busby's post-war halcyon days, telling the story of eight pioneers ranging from miners to brewery owners and fitness fanatics to portly beer drinkers. From Stretford, Ancoats, Birmingham, Bolton, Darlington, Chirk and Crewe. Some were rebels, others were leaders. All were grafters. This is a story behind the club's name and colours, the building of Old Trafford, the founding of the PFA and the creation of the academy. If that interests you, go have a look online and buy it if you so wish. And just get in touch on Twitter if you'd like a signed copy at a special discount price for United Through Time listeners. Now, on with the show. This is the story of a visionary businessman who laid the foundations for the modern Manchester United. This is the story of a man who answered United's desperate calls in the Great Depression, who worked with Secretary Walter Crickmer to create the academy, and who played a part in the evolution of the Football Manager by appointing and trusting a fresh-faced Matt Busby after the Second World War. This is the man who rebuilt Manchester United twice. This is James W. Gibson, and this is United Through Time. When Manchester United's long-serving president John Henry Davies died in 1927, there were fears that the club, often playing in front of a small crowd inside the vast Old Trafford Stadium, would decline. They already had since their pre-World War I halcyon days, and those fears came true, exaggerated further still by the 1929 Wall Street crash and subsequent Great Depression. United needed a saviour, a second coming. Welcome, James W. Gibson, a clothing magnate and proud Mancunian. Few men have established the global reputation of Manchester United more prolifically than this Salford-born businessman, who had only a vague interest in football before Walter Crickmer arrived at his house in Hale Barnes and asked him to save one of the city's finest institutions. James Gibson would end up saving Manchester United twice. Welcome to episode 8 of United Through Time, the story of James Gibson. United Through Time is the podcast delving into the history of Manchester United with extensive original research, thorough interviews and immersive documentaries. Going in chronological order, the podcast looks at the most influential individuals from Newton Heath to Manchester United in the modern day. I'm your host, Harry Robinson, a Manchester United fan, historian and freelance journalist and author of the upcoming book, The Men Who Made Manchester United, out in September 2023 with Pitch Publishing. My wonderful guests today are Tony Park, author of Sons of United, Jim White, author of Manchester United, the biography, among other works, and Alan Embling, great nephew of James W. Gibson himself.
Don't forget, it is the offshoot of it. How many people around Old Trafford make a living out of being near to Old Trafford? Fish and chip shops, restaurants, pubs. There's people letting space out for car parks and all sorts. People are making money. They would get a living from what James Gibson did. A lot of people, Trafford Council gets an income from the people coming backwards and forwards to Old Trafford. The people come from all over the world to Old Trafford. They wouldn't do that if it wasn't for the fact that that club has done so well.
He's right. This is Alan Embling, great nephew of James Gibson.
You're talking to the only living person who actually knew James Gibson. I'm the only person alive in this living world that actually knew him personally. I'm last man standing. Yes, he was a remarkable man.
Football clubs are institutions and a vital part of the communities in which they exist. When that football club is the size of Manchester United, that only becomes truer. The club employs more than 3,000 matchday staff, as well as all those in permanent positions at Old Trafford, nearby offices, Carrington, The Cliff, London, the Manchester United Foundation, journalists, photographers, cameramen, producers covering the club. All of these people are beneficiaries of the work of James Gibson and the men who made Manchester United. And this is his story. Enjoy. October 1931. Walter Crickmer, subject of episode 7, that small, amicable Lancastrian who always took two steps at a time. He was Manchester United's club secretary and also its interim manager, and he had been for some months. It had not meant to be this way. Back in the summer, United's directors searched hard for a new boss, but even with the coach of third division Barrow, negotiations broke down. Several months on from this embarrassment, their desperation had become more frenzied still, and now not for a Crickmer replacement, but instead for the club's finances. They had begged the Manchester Brewery Company to delay mortgage payments. They asked the Stretford Council to pay their road charges in instalments, and they sent a query to Inland Revenue to see if income tax payment could be postponed. And after that, still, a circular was sent around the Football League asking for offers for players. November then, and the club's annual shareholders meeting. Chairman George Lawton, involved with United for nearly three decades, finally, offered an element of transparency to supporters. In November 1931, he explained that United needed money. They could not buy new players, and in fact, they needed some new, well-off gentlemen to get involved.
I want it to be known that myself and my colleagues on the board of directors will certainly retire if there is someone who will come forward with cash and help the club.
This was undoubtedly the right thing to do, but like every positive move the directors made in these years building up to 1931, it was much too late. Chairman George Lawton blamed the global depression, bad weather and injuries, but nowhere did he and his partners take culpability for poor team selection, inadequate investment, unsuccessful signings, irrational departures, and the until then closed off relationship with supporters. Financial help was not instantly forthcoming. Advent arrived and everyone involved with Manchester United faced a bleak winter period. Walter Crickmer, for example, with his 10-year-old daughter Beryl at home, knew his very job was on the line. No United, no job. He visited the National Provincial Bank in Manchester Spring Gardens and the bank clerk there told him that Manchester United could not pay their players. There was nothing left. It had gone midday back at Old Trafford and Louis Rocca, the second-generation Italian immigrant, ice cream man, chief scout, assistant manager and all-round United fixture. Back at Old Trafford after hours passed, several players came to his office to ask if their wages had arrived yet. He told them to go home with a white lie that Crickmer had been delayed by a director's meeting. The lads did as they were told, with a few offering the same parting remark.
Don't forget our Christmas turkeys.
I've long been interested in Manchester United.
54-year-old Salford-born clothing magnate James Gibson said, having just gifted the club £2,000 and enough money to buy the players and staff their Christmas turkeys.
I am at the head of the United now, and if the public will back me up and give me any justification for carrying on, I will assure them that the United will not fail. I want to place Manchester United, if possible, on a level with the great teams of the country, such as Arsenal. And I also want to see the pop side people at Old Trafford afforded some protection from the bad weather. When I have been down at Old Trafford and have seen the Shilling supporters standing in the wet, I have felt heartily sorry for them. I want to get covered accommodation at Old Trafford. Of course, this cannot be done in a twinkling, but if the public will come forward, then I will do my best. And I will also see that the United have a manager who will be one of the best in the country and will be paid accordingly. I shall then look to the first team. I do not blame the public in the least for staying away from Old Trafford. The United Board of Management have never taken the public into their confidence, and they could not be expected to keep on rolling up at Old Trafford while a hush-hush policy was being adhered to.
This admirable philanthropist was formally introduced to Manchester United by Stacey Lintott, a member of his regular luncheon group and the North's preeminent football journalist. Lintott, an ex-player, arranged a meeting between James Gibson and United Secretary Walter Crickmer. The result was the saving of Manchester United. Gibson could be considered a Mancunian nationalist. He was a uniform manufacturer, like his father, and at the time of these comments about United, had been for three decades. But he hadn't simply assumed his family's company. No, James endured a series of tragedies in his early teens. His Irish-born father John and Salfordian mother Eliza both died, followed by his paternal grandmother, who had been looking after him and his two siblings.
He had an awful lot of sadness in his young life. He lost both his parents. His grandmother then died and he was looked after by William Fell.
As great-nephew Alan Embling says, the Gibson children then moved in with their uncle and two aunts in Moss Side. James worked for his uncle's corn merchant company, and there he quickly demonstrated business acumen equal to that of his late father. After several years under his uncle's tutelage, Gibson returned to Salford to pursue his father's trade, uniform manufacturing. In 1900, he formed Briggs, Jones & Gibson Limited. He was just 23 years old, but the company carried his name because his father's reputation had been a good one and just about lingered on. First acting as company secretary, Gibson soon became director, but was yet to escape tragedy. His sister Florence died too, aged only 14. James soon met Cheetham-born Annie, later Lillian, and they settled happily in Old Trafford. But still, the immense heartbreak worsened. Their son, Norman, died aged 3. Twins died at birth, and several years on, in November 1915, Lillian gave birth to triplets. And once again, death ravaged the family when two of the triplets died. Thankfully, with the aid of cotton wool wrapping and constant nursing, one survived, Alan. His health was poor, with a weak chest and long-lasting effects from pneumonia, which would make ordinary life difficult. But Lillian cared for him, while still finding the time to help nurse troops in the Manchester area during the First World War. It was the needs brought about by this global conflict that allowed Briggs, Jones and Gibson to truly flourish. They supplied military uniforms for young soldiers like Walter Crickmer, then known as Raymond, and an unceasing demand was matched by endless expansion at Gibson's factory. Young men and women were employed at the most rapid rate, trained as machinists, finishers, pressers, embroiderers and trimmers. Gibson took immense pride in employing so many local Mancunians and was desperate after the war to maintain the company's size and thus its staff.
He could see the First World War coming to an end, so he had to think how he could keep his workforce. He wanted to retain and give people work. And so he then sold an idea of, if you go back in the old photographs, the tram drivers and the conductors and trolley bus people, they wore their own clothes. The only way you distinguished the ticket collector was because he had a leather strap with a ticket thing over him. So anyway, he got the corporations to buy into the idea of putting their drivers and conductors into uniforms. So therefore, he was making uniforms for police forces and for bus and tram drivers and train drivers and so on. So that kept him going all through the Depression. So therefore, he was able to keep his workforce intact. And of course, he made some money.
Yes. Gibson provided uniforms at local and national level, and so his company was indeed fairly depression-resistant come October 1929's Wall Street crash, by which point James had taken over his company outright and moved to bigger premises on Lostock Street near Miles Platting, the original birthplace of Newton Heath LMYR Football Club. Gibson was born in Salford in 1877. He grew up as football fever began to spread through Manchester. In his 20s, Manchester City and Manchester United both won the FA Cup. But Gibson was no football fanatic, somehow immune to the epidemic sweeping the city.
He wasn't really a football fan, but he was a big fan of Manchester, which is quite important for what he did later on.
That's not to say he was unathletic, though, or not a sports fan. He just preferred rugby in his youth. And in his attic, he'd throw himself at a punch bag for those moments of frustration and anger that any young man deprived of his parents, grandparents and sister would have. No boyhood football fanaticism for Gibson then. But by 1931, he had become an Old Trafford season ticket holder and was friends with directors at Manchester City. He admired greatly football's power to evoke such great passion and to distract from everyday life's grim reality during the economic downturn.
Gibson loved what he found. That was the interesting thing. He hadn't been to football. He wasn't a regular attender. He wasn't a wannabe chairman in any shape or form.
James Gibson explained this to United Secretary Walter Crickmer when the pair sat down at the former's Hale Barnes residence, Eleanor, named after the two Gibson sons, Norman, who died aged 3, and Alan, now 16. Gibson and Crickmer got on with ease. Walter was an honest, straightforward man, and James liked that. For his part, Crickmer was impressed by Gibson's immediate, eager specificity. Gibson asked Crickmer exactly how much United brought in, with regard to gate receipts for the first team, reserve team and away games, and how much they spend in the form of player and staff wages, bonuses, expenses, payments for benefit matches and tax. He also wanted to know how much United were overdrawn at the bank and which positions Walter Crickmer would strengthen if the club had some money to spend. Gibson bid Crickmer farewell after this meeting with a promise to act, and shortly after, the wealthy businessman contacted United chairman George Lawton and offered to immediately deposit £2,000 in the club's account.
He gave that £2,000 not as a loan, not with no strings attached, as a complete outright gift to the club to pay the backlog of all the players' salaries and the officials.
This £2,000 was an outright gift, and one which lifted the most enormous weight from Walter Crickmer's shoulders and that of everyone else at United. It was enough to pay the salaries of the players and staff for a few weeks, even if there was still a need to be frugal for now.
But there was enough money left over, and as a gift from him, every player and official had the biggest turkeys they could lay their hands on as a Christmas present from him. So what was going to be a very bleak, horrible Christmas for the players and officials turned out to be a very nice Christmas.
By the 21st of December, the full directorship told Gibson that they would resign en masse whenever he wanted them to do so, despite his intense public criticism of their actions. But that time was not immediate. James wanted to see some proof in the form of a bumper Old Trafford crowd that United were worth saving. What the public was not made aware of was that Gibson had realised exactly how critical United's condition was. He believed the directors had, in fact, underestimated the debt, which he valued at least £26,000. And still, he was willing to get stuck in. Around Christmas, Gibson already had the backing of the necessary people. The FA and the Football League were keen to see him take over, and so was Amy Davies, the widow of John Henry, president of United for 25 years from 1902 until his 1927 death. After his death, Amy had become the so-called mother of Manchester United. She was not the typical United fan, sitting before a blazing Yule log fire in the oak-rafted library of her Elizabethan Cheshire mansion, but her opinions were always received well by supporters, who had an enduring respect for the Davies family.
"Tell the public to rally round,"
Amy told a reporter.
"He knows what he wants and will get it. He has the spirit of the game in him and he loves the team."
Amy was not the only key figure to offer support to Gibson. Supporters club head honcho George Greenhoff, leader of the 1930 attempted boycott detailed in episode 7 of United Through Time, was also enthusiastic about the changes.
"I know nothing,"
James Gibson said upon temporary takeover of Manchester United, talking about football. But what he lacked in football knowledge, he more than made up for in business and PR acumen. His first smart move was to turn down the opportunity of picking the team himself. Instead, Gibson won supporters over immediately by asking for the opinion of supporters club head honcho, George Greenhoff. As a result, United's selection committee was made up of Greenhoff, Walter Crickmer, the trainer Jack Puller, and Navigator, the reporter from the Manchester Evening News.
"He was very shrewd."
This is Jim White speaking.
"It had been an attempt to stage a boycott in protest against the old regime. Gibson very early on got the guy who was in charge of the potential revolution. It was a guy called George Greenhoff, and he was in charge of the Manchester United supporters group that was very, the pop side, which is basically what is the Alex Ferguson stand at Old Trafford, was renowned throughout football as being the moaniest stand in football. You know, there were the complaints from the pop stand were legendary, Greenhoff basically got all those people together just moaning and moaning everything was wrong. They wanted a complete clear out of the board and so on. So Gibson very cleverly got Greenhoff involved, got him in on side very quickly. Greenhoff dissolved the would-be revolutionaries, got completely on side, and fair enough, because everything he'd asked for had effectively been done. He wanted a change of directors, he wanted a change of direction, and he wanted a change of management, and all those things had come about. So Gibson was shrewd. He got everybody on side. Greenhoff worked pretty hard to make sure everybody realised this was the start of something new.
These clever moves didn't see Gibson hailed universally as a saviour. In fact, concerns were raised that he sought to be a dictator, and there was great criticism of his demand for fans to show up to earn his investment.
"It is too much like Jam Tomorrow,"
commented the Manchester Evening News, conveniently forgetting the £2,000 Gibson had already gifted the club.
"Why am I doing this?"
Gibson patiently responded.
"Because I believe in football. It is the finest recreation for spectators that the country has."
James Gibson had asked for a bumper Old Trafford crowd on Christmas Day to prove that United fans and Mancunians wanted to see the club recover and do well. On the same day, United's reserves played Wolves at Molineux. Louis Rocker and reserve team coach Billy Meredith arrived at Old Trafford at 3:30 on Christmas morning. Gibson's money had got the club back on its feet, but there was certainly still no excess to spend. Whereas usually the reserves would travel to Wolverhampton the night before and stay at the Victoria Hotel, finances now dictated the impossibility of that. So Rocker and Meredith made preparations while awaiting the players' 5am arrival. When the lads eventually arrived in Wolverhampton, Rocker took them to the Stafford Hotel, where they enjoyed a reviving round of toast and a warming cuppa. On telling the hotel manager of their situation, Rocker received great sympathy. The manager told him to bring the boys back right after the game, and he'd serve Christmas dinner for a bargain price. The reserves played like men inspired and forced a strong Wolves team to a draw. Then they got that turkey they thought they'd missed out on this year, and Christmas pudding and a glass of wine as well. With full bellies and a smile, they made the journey home, with Rocker in particular anxious to discover the fate of United's first team back at Old Trafford. As the party neared sail, they met crowds of people walking away from Stretford with broad smiles on their faces. They stopped to ask for the result and were told United had won 3-2 against Division 2's best side, Wolves, and more than 40,000 watched on. Rocker leapt in excitement and the group cheered themselves hoarse. The local public of Cottonopolis had certainly shown that they believed in James Gibson, even if the cynics in the press did not. And so, Manchester United were saved. The crowd was not quite 40,000, with an official attendance of 33,000, but Gibson had clearly got his message across, and the supporters had given him one in return. It was the biggest crowd, excepting derby matches against City, for 3 years, and like former President John Henry Davies back in 1902, Gibson was genuinely moved by what he saw. At half-time, he went down to the popular side to thank fans for showing up. He promised them, in a fever of excitement, that United will go on.
They won, he loved it, everyone loved him. And he fell in love with the club pretty immediately and remained as chairman for another 20 years.
Over the next few weeks, Gibson met with United directors, FA officials, Football League presidents, vice presidents and committee men, and soon enough, he was co-opted as director at United. He then took full responsibility for the club's liabilities, a figure in excess of £40,000. By doing so, and the reason for him doing so, he saved United £1,000 in bank fees a month, but only at great personal risk to himself. To try and reduce some of that personal risk, Gibson wanted to raise funds with a patron's ticket, whereby supporters would pay in advance to secure ground admission for 4 years. A four-year season ticket, in essence. His main target for this was Manchester businessmen, and he emphasised to them how football could be a place for businesses and businessmen to take friends, acquaintances and staff. He did have a good business brain. The tickets offered a saving of a third, but they elicited a very poor response. Only £500 came in, with Gibson having hoped to create something larger, more like £10,000, to create a transfer fund and help United avoid relegation to Division 3. Privately disappointed, but publicly resolute, Gibson accepted the timing was bad. Just after Christmas, just before the tax payment deadline, and, of course, amid an economic depression. He was also not targeting the club's normal one-shilling supporter, and so the poor uptake, he felt, didn't reflect badly on the main support's commitment. Regardless of all this, any lingering disappointment disappeared immediately when Gibson opened a letter at his new Old Trafford office.
"There was one man who was a supporter but couldn't attend matches because of his work. And he sent a postal order to my uncle and said that he hoped that this would help. And it was a postal order for sixpence, which is 2.5p in today's money. My uncle was humbled, so humbled by that, that somebody should do that. That's all he could afford, but he gave that money to support that patron's ticket." Now, that moved him greatly.
A fortnight later, a moved and determined Gibson finally accepted the directors' resignations ahead of creating an entirely new United setup, with the exceptions of the ever-reliable, ever-loyal and ever-valuable Walter Krickmer and Louis Rocker. In future years, Gibson would thank the heavens he kept these two men around. His new board, meanwhile, was made up of an ex-Lord Mayor of Manchester, a Stalybridge woollen manufacturer, a cotton merchant and a company director at Horrocks' Crewston Limited. All four had money behind them, which was helpful because Manchester's general public had precisely none. Another week on, and James W. Gibson was officially made president of Manchester United. A new era beckoned. In his first 100 days as president, James Gibson ensured United's continued Division 2 status. He stabilised the club's finances with great personal sacrifice. He trebled both the Old Trafford crowd size and entertainment on show, and he laid the first cornerstone of future success in the form of the A-team. It was a year before Franklin D. Roosevelt emphasised the significance and opportunity of an American president's first 100 days, so it is instead to a quote from a previous president that Gibson's achievements can be contextualised. In Abraham Lincoln's words, he left nothing for tomorrow which could be done today. And it was the A-team that was key. In March's final directors' meeting, James Gibson discussed
the advisability of running a Colts team or nursery as from next season.
The matter was left in the club secretary, Walter Krickmer's hands. Whereas the reserve team hosted players equipped to replace injured first-teamers, with the occasional trialist and youngster being assessed, this new side, christened the A-team, would be a breeding ground for young, talented players. It allowed, in effect, Louis Rocker to assemble eager and coachable talent one day primed to rise into the seniors. Krickmer, as well as Rocker, was especially enthused by this project, the birth of United's academy. He headed to Altrincham and negotiated the use of their ground at a £25 annual fee, secured a spot for United in the Manchester League, and convinced Lau Hilditch, the old player-manager from 1926-27, to coach the side. With plans for the A-team in place and Krickmer working hard behind the scenes, James Gibson's first task for the summer was appointing a permanent replacement for Walter, who could thus slide back into his role as secretary. He had enough to do in that role, after all, especially now working under an ambitious man like Gibson. As ever, James turned to those he trusted for advice and recommendations, namely Stacey Lintott, the sports journalist and lunching partner who had brought Gibson and Krickmer together just 5 months before. Lintott suggested Urmston-born Frank Buckley, who made a few appearances for United in a typically short stint in a playing career defined by them elsewhere at Aston Villa, Brighton City, Birmingham, Derby, Bradford and Norwich. Buckley made a greater name for himself, although he did get one England cap as a player, as a major in the army and then a manager, first at Norwich and then at Blackpool, where he began implementing a youth and scouting system. Wolverhampton Wanderers poached him in 1927, and there he showed himself to be a no-nonsense manager with a direct style of football and an emphasis on youth. Lintott believed he'd fit United perfectly, and Gibson was interested. Buckley, however, was well settled in at Wolves. The interest, though, said a lot. Gibson was clearly targeting a manager specifically for their track record with young players. And it's worth wondering whether Matt Busby would have ended up at United if the major, Frank Buckley, had come first back in the 1930s. Instead of the major, though, Gibson turned to Scott Duncan.
So what happened was Gibson had this vision that, and when he took over in 32, one of the first things he did was hire Scott Duncan as the manager. And he gave Duncan a very specific remit, which was, you know, let's get youth football started.
A Scotsman, Duncan had been a player at Dumbarton, Rangers and Newcastle United before heading into management with Hamilton Academicals and most prominently with Cowdenbeath, who he turned into a stable top-flight club with clever signings and development of talented local youngsters. He certainly fit the bill. Duncan bought into the idea of youth and the A-team, and he did improve things at United. But that improvement was not immediate, nor sustained, nor all-encompassing. In fact, a couple of years in, James Gibson's faith in Manchester United was being tested. 18 months into Duncan's tenure as manager, United sat 20th out of 22 second-tier sides. The third division loomed ominously below. Clubs had been known to canter up the table after Christmas, but it was an undoubtedly bleak outlook, made worse still by significant boardroom unrest. Gibson had a disagreement with two directors, who subsequently resigned. This latest problem only added to some fairly major and certainly justifiable concerns he was having. The idea of throwing in the towel was not a Gibson characteristic, not in business, family, health or hobbies, but United's future was unpredictable. The club's overdraft was growing unsettlingly large, and while James had boldly made himself responsible for it back in 1932, he wondered if that was all a rush of blood to the head. How had he been convinced to plough on by one supporter's couple of pennies in a letter, he thought. Well, he remembered exactly why, when he witnessed the steadfast support of those inside Old Trafford, but nevertheless, his financial anxieties were justified. Manager Scott Duncan had spent a lot of money with quite pathetic on-pitch returns, a sixth place finished in his first season and now 20th in the second tier midway through the campaign. United's overdraft stood at £17,705 and Gibson was responsible for all but £5,000 of that, which was managed by Amy Davies, John Henry's widow. On the pitch, the players seemed beset by an inferiority complex and the squad was undoubtedly injury afflicted. Over the season, Scott Duncan used a quite ridiculous 38 players. Gibson backed Duncan though, and certainly never interfered with team selection. As for his own future, Gibson's that is, there were many involved at United with a clear vested interest in keeping him around. Figures like Crickmer and Rocker, as well as the supporters. Crickmer would have known or heard of Gibson's wobble, but reassurance was soon forthcoming. Even with United seemingly plummeting towards the third division, Gibson had an eye on the long-term future. The United president began working on a scheme to improve Old Trafford's accessibility. The nearest train station was then at the cricket ground, but Gibson envisaged a new drop-off point right outside the football ground's entrance. And in March, he showed his worries had been temporary only when he replaced the departed board members. Back into the fold came an old friend of the late John Henry Davies, the 1908 Olympic football gold medalist Harold Hardman, who had resigned upon Gibson's arrival back in 1932. United won 3 of 6 games in March, elevating them into a relegation scrap which they, at times, seemed too far removed from. Their opponents in the scrap were Swansea Town and Millwall, and it was the latter side that United faced on the season's final day. United, 32 points. Millwall, 33. It was, effectively, a relegation playoff match. And United were underdogs, requiring an unlikely away victory. In fact, so meagre were expectations that a third division manager had already phoned Secretary Walter Crickmer to arrange next season's games in the third tier. Walter politely told him to wait and see what would happen. Indeed, a magnificent performance and victory kept United up and condemned Millwall to the drop. And once the euphoria had died down, things calmed at United. The team enjoyed a pleasantly uneventful season the following year, with George Much's 18 goals helping them to a decent position on the very edge of the promotion battle, and an almost £5,000 profit removed James Gibson's financial concerns. Another George, as well as Much, this time George Vose, was one of United's most important players too, a significant fact for he was the first graduate of Gibson and Crickmer's A-team, and many more were coming through too. At the start of the 1935-1936 season, Gibson's business acumen and courage shone through again. And simultaneously,
he did some clever things. He persuaded the Midland Railway to open a station at Old Trafford. The track was always running there, and he got them to open a station, which meant it was much easier to get the fans in there. You know, he had a shrewd idea for business as well.
So in the early 30s, he negotiated with the railway authority for the platform at Old Trafford to be, steps to be built up and the trains to stop. The mainline trains to stop at Old Trafford on match days so the supporters could get backwards and forwards easily to games.
Indeed, some Reds might have forgotten this in the modern era, but Old Trafford is served by a railway station directly next to the ground. Due to the modern terrorist threat, it's not operated for several years now, but it was a valuable transport link for decades, and it began with Gibson. The United Football Ground railway station opened for the team's first match of the 35-36 season against Charlton Athletic, and the programme's cartoonist George Butterworth, known as GB, relished the opportunity for a pun or ten.
Station Master Gibson, Inspector Scott Duncan and Porter Curry have trained a first-class team on the right lines, and right from the whistle we'll go full steam ahead.
Gibson loved these cartoons and actually personally commissioned them for each programme, and he could be seen chuckling in his seat reading them before the game. The station had a shuttle service of steam-hauled trains from Munster Central, which operated from an hour before the game until 5 minutes before kickoff. It was quick, only 5 minutes, and cheap, only 2 pence each way. And it was Gibson's latest brainchild, and another one for which he took on significant personal risk. To persuade the local railway committees to permit the venture, United guaranteed the construction costs. It made it a win-win scenario for the Cheshire Lines Committee, but it required courage and conviction from Gibson. He was putting his own money on the line. It was brave, forward-looking and innovative. It dropped supporters 15 yards from the turnstile to the main stand, something unique for English football. United earned promotion in 1936, and then they were relegated in 1937. But there was no panic upon relegation, not like in the 1920s. There was confidence that United were building well. The A-team had reaped dividends, the railway line was boosting crowds, and United were turning a profit regularly. Youth was beginning to consume the club, with Scott Duncan bringing in a kid called Charlie Mitten and Louis Rocker's team of scouts talented youngsters like Johnny Kerry, Stan Pearson, Johnny Morris, Burt Redwood, Harry Worrell and many others. James Gibson, meanwhile, contributes a player himself, Jack Rowley, a prolific centre-forward he spotted while watching Bournemouth, the closest team to his holiday cottage on the south coast. He pays £3,000 for him. Within weeks, manager Scott Duncan is gone. He's accepted a job at Ipswich Town. He and Gibson's relationship has deteriorated, the Rowley signing unlikely to have helped. It is the manner of the signing that displeased Duncan, not the player, because Rowley is brilliant. Walter Crickmer takes interim charge again for the first time in 5 years and does a wonderful job. You can read the thrilling story of how he immediately injected youth into United's side with extraordinary results in The Men Who Made Manchester United. But what you need to know is this. James Gibson stuck with United's interim manager. Crickmer became secretary manager and everyone at the club took things up a notch.
Together with Walter Crickmer, created MUJAC, the Manchester United Junior Athletics Club.
Now under Crickmer's charge, United were promoted again in the 1937-38 season and playing good football too. And in the summer of that promotion, the MUJAC was founded. Gibson's mission statement was this.
We have no intention of buying any more mediocrities. From now on, we will have a Manchester United composed of Manchester players. It was not just that there was going to be a football club that was successful, but that it was going to be a football club that was made up of young Mancunians. This is what he wanted.
The summer of 1938 was a World Cup summer. And 2 days after Italy won a second World Cup, their manager Vittorio Pozzo's tactics inspired by the play of Charlie Roberts and Billy Meredith back in 1908, James Gibson completed the purchase of the Cliff Training Ground in Salford. He had emphasised the necessity for a training pitch for practice games for both the A-team and the new MUJAC.
MUJAC, may I add a note about this mystic word?
United Review editor Sidney Wicks helpfully noted.
It stands for Manchester United Junior Athletic Club.
Within a 7-mile radius of United's Old Trafford ground were 250 schoolboy football teams with upwards of 3,000 players. The Manchester United Junior Athletic Club, or MUJAC, was created in order that none of these sides' most promising players' talent would be wasted. Gibson urged the scheme on. Crickmer led the organisation and Rocker continued to be chief scout and all-round fixer. By August, United were holding a trial day for the new MUJAC at the Cliff, paid for by Gibson. The hundreds of young talents there were whittled down to 30 to play across two teams, A and B. The boys chosen were buzzing. Many of them had turned out for Manchester, Salford or Lancashire boys, while others were complete unknowns. But whatever their reputation before, it was clear that Walter Crickmer, with the assistance of local teachers and his scouts, had brought the best young Mancunian footballers all together in one place. But still, what James Gibson made clear was this.
The only condition he put on them was they would consider. And the word is consider playing for United. He didn't put you've got to play, consider.
Being a MUJAC was thus an opportunity to learn and to thrive. It was not an obligation to play and not an obligation to play for United. Those selected for now competed in the Chiltern and District Amateur League against players significantly older than them. And still, the MUJACs utterly dominated their division. James Gibson was thrilled upon hearing of the youngsters' progress. He was a proud Salfordian and Mancunian, and it was his fundamental ambition for United to represent the two cities on the global stage. He was immensely grateful to Walter Crickmer for his work on this and on every project, and he didn't hide it either. At a board meeting less than a year on from Scott Duncan's departure to Ipswich Town, Gibson paid a particularly glowing tribute to the marvellous Crickmer, who has
more than replaced the energies that any manager could have put in.
Again, you can read the in-depth MUJAC story in The Men Who Made Manchester United, but what you need to know is this. They were flying, the cream of the crop, and so were United. At the end of the 1939 season, the reserves had won the Central League title for the first time in 18 years. They'd also won the Manchester Senior Cup. The A-team had won the Manchester League, and the Mujacks, the new Mujacks, had won their division. The first team was impressing too. Throughout these teams, you've got names of the future like Stan Pearson, Johnny Kerry, Jack Rowley, Charlie Mitten and John Aston. And at the end of the season, two goals from Jimmy Hanlon gave United a final day victory to finish 14th in the top flight, their best position for a decade. Like a proud father post-match, Gibson presented George Vose, the first graduate of the A-team, with a £650 cheque for his benefit, and in a short speech, emphasised the splendid service that George had given the club. He had, without a doubt, been the most consistent United player of the decade. Everyone in attendance couldn't fail to be aware of the cyclical nature of the game. In Vose's debut season, Gibson had considered throwing in the towel until the Reds managed an inspired two-goal win away at Millwall to avoid dropping into the third division. 6 years on, the team were a top-flight club, with three title-winning teams of talent ready to take the next step up. Crickmer, Gibson and Rocker had not simply dragged Manchester United off the lip of the cliff. It seemed they may well have set this club up for greatness. But
he'd had 10 years of rebuilding a club to see it all smashed by the bombs. And when he learned of that, that's the only time my cousin said he saw his father cry.
2 years into the Second World War, then known as Hitler's War, Manchester United's Old Trafford Stadium was destroyed by a stray Luftwaffe bomb. It had survived December 1940's haunting blitz, but in March of the following year, it could not. James Gibson just broke down and wept.
Yeah, in 1941 when we were bombed, you know, we had nothing. The whole club was nothing. There was no pitch, there was no stands, there was nothing. We had nothing. No players, they're all at war. We had nothing.
Old Trafford's demise was as symbolic a blow as they come. Just a decade before, Manchester United teetered on the brink of bankruptcy. Walter Crickmer, James Gibson and Louis Rocker built the Reds back up. They now faced the gut-wrenching reality that their club had been turned to rubble. The club, to its core, it felt, had been destroyed. The soul remained, of course, but it was a heartbreaking sight. The shirts were gone, the shorts were gone, the balls were gone, the boots were gone. The club records and the gymnasium and the pitch were gone. The end of this famous Manchester institution seemed possible once again. Old Trafford was worthless. There would be no income from matches. The buildings were worth almost nothing, and the cost of clearing the site alone would be huge. But still, James Gibson
decided he would rebuild the club. So, in fact, he not only once, but he actually saved that club and rebuilt it twice.
Crickmer worked tirelessly with a quite unbelievable work ethic to drag United through the war, supported by Gibson when necessary. It was Crickmer's efforts that got United through it, with Gibson having to focus on other businesses as well. But his finances again propped the club up throughout it all. He'd seen United get so close to achieving his grand vision of Manchester United made of Manchester players at the very top of the English game. He wanted to see it come to fruition, and so he had it on his mind at all times. When visiting Dorset in 1942, Gibson chatted with an old friend, Captain Bill Williams, who had become sports officer for the Southern Command. With an eye always on the end of war, Gibson asked if Bill knew of any young officers who might be suitable to take on the United managerial job, and Matt Busby was the subsequent recommendation. Gibson didn't leave it there either. He wanted to see Matt play and get a sense of his character, so he went to watch Bournemouth, for whom Busby was guesting, and was very impressed. 2 years on, Louis Rocker heard rumblings that Busby had been offered a good job at Liverpool and was being tracked by other clubs for their managerial positions too. Louis and Matt were old friends, and so Rocker told Gibson to leave it with him. Within months, Matt Busby was signing to become United's first post-war manager, but only after some serious conversations with James Gibson.
When they first met, Busby set out some fairly rigorous instructions about how he wanted to operate. There would be no directorial interference in terms of picking teams. There would be it would not be management by committee anymore. It was management by one man. And Gibson was happy to accede to that.
Busby was happy to stop playing football, even if slightly earlier than anticipated. But if he was to become manager, he wanted absolute control over anything at the club he thought was relevant to playing success, including coaching appointments, player recruitment, and changes even to the infrastructure. Gibson admired his conviction. He suggested to Busby a contract of 3 years. Busby asked, or demanded rather, for 5. Gibson accepted. It was a significant commitment, a brave chance taken on a young, unproven coach.
I think that the appointment of Busby, which is possibly Gibson and Crickmer's finest moment, that was the sort of single evidence of that. That he knew how far he could go, but he needed someone to put his vision to work on the football field. And he recognised in Busby from the moment they first met, when Busby came for an interview in the winter of 1944-45, that this was the man who could put his vision into proper practice.
Gibson's trust in Walter Crickmer back in the 1930s had been essential to the success of United. His belief in Matt Busby came from the same ability to admit his own weaknesses and to delegate, one of the surest signs of good leadership. And he certainly delegated and deferred to Matt Busby.
I think it's to Gibson's enormous credit, and it also became even more so in evidence when they employed Busby, that he was a man who delegated. He was a man who realised, hey, you know what you're doing. Yeah, you sort this out.
Crickmer maintained charge of United until autumn 1945, when Busby was demobbed. The Football League proper did not return until the next season, allowing Matt time to settle and mould his team. Crickmer's work pre and mid-war provided Matt with the tools he needed for success. He gave him pretty much a talented side ready to challenge for the big honours, and that cannot be forgotten. Busby did make one signing, and just one signing.
You know, one of the first things that Busby wanted to do once they got going after the war was to buy an experienced player. He bought Jimmy Delaney from Celtic, and Gibson actually paid the transfer fee out of his own pocket, not out of United's funds. So he trusted Busby and saw in him a man who was going to, yeah, as you say, put that vision into practice.
Busby had bought into Gibson's vision entirely. In fact, he ended up protecting Gibson's vision from Gibson himself. Busby and his assistant manager, Jimmy Murphy, moulded the team bequeathed to them by Crickmer. Cultivating a family atmosphere, they secured United's highest finish since the 1911 title, ending just 1 point behind Busby's old club, Liverpool, in the 1946-47 season. It was an immense achievement, given the Reds made only one major signing post-war in Jimmy Delaney. A mini player wage revolt combated over summer, United slipped into a 9-match winless streak that left them teetering above the relegation zone in mid-October 1947. To some, it appeared the regression to the mean after the previous year's heroics. A concerned James Gibson urged Busby to go and sign someone and suggested several names himself. Remember, this was a man who signed Jack Rowley off his own back in the 30s. But Busby said no. The subsequent argument, and it was an argument, ended only when Gibson stormed out of the room. But United's president returned late that day to apologise. In doing so, he gave Busby his unequivocal, active backing.
Is anyone interfering with you?
Gibson would then ask his manager constantly.
If there is, he'll have to go.
He would have removed any director threatening to interfere with Busby's vision. Matt had insisted he had the right players and wanted to build things properly, as they had agreed back in February 1945. And he was proved right. By the start of the 1948 FA Cup campaign, United were 13 matches unbeaten and had climbed to fourth. They travelled to 8th place Aston Villa to begin their cup run. A remarkable 6-4 victory followed. Entertaining, certainly, but little unpolished from Busby's Reds. The same could not be said in the next round. With Manchester City also drawn at home, United had to play elsewhere. Facing Liverpool, Busby cleverly took his boys to Goodison Park, and after a dominant 3-0 victory, the newspaper's reaction said it all.
This sort of soccer is more like sorcery.
Charlton and Preston North End were both beaten, and then a Stan Pearson hat-trick blew Derby County away in the semi-final. United thus reached a first FA Cup final since 1909, when Busby was not yet born. And they did so by beating sides who had finished the season placed 4th, 6th, 7th, 11th and 13th in England's top flight. With 18 goals scored in 5 matches, 3 clean sheets and just 1 match at even their temporary home of Main Road, it was widely regarded as one of the FA Cup's most extraordinary runs, and it made United the country's favourite club. Journalists were calling them the best footballing side since the First World War.
A glance at the new Olympic Road gives a pretty good idea of the crowd that went to the cup final.
United's flowing football inspired Manchester as it was reeling from war. Hundreds of buses departed the city for Wembley with an 8-hour journey time, while others were on the train, including the team. Red and white scarves abounded, others pinned huge rosettes onto their Sunday best, and wooden rattles clacked endlessly. It was United's first Wembley appearance. For those who attended back in 1909 at the Crystal Palace ground, it was an even more remarkable sight. The Imperial Stadium living up to its expectation, recently embellished by the newly constructed walkway towards the Twin Towers in preparations for the summer's Olympic Games. It was London's first Olympics since 1908, the year United won their first title with Davies, Magnell, Meredith and Roberts. This time, it was Gibson, Crickmer and Rocker who had got them here, having passed the mantle on to Busby, Murphy, Joe Armstrong, Bert Wally, Tom Curry and the rest of their supporting cast. The sunlit Wembley turf was pristine and the densely packed terraces produced a slow and moving rendition of Abide With Me. Just 3 years before, the world had been at war, and lying in graves across the continent were men and women who would have otherwise stood shoulder to shoulder with their brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, grandfathers, grandmothers and friends, about to watch their football team compete for the highest honour. Khaki-clad young men on the terraces were a reminder of this, and national service remained in place. King George VI strolled out, greeted by the national anthem. Wearing royal blue, Johnny Kerry took immense pride in introducing His Royal Highness to his teammates. United kicked off and Blackpool punished their slow start by taking a 12th minute lead. Allenby Chilton tripped Stan Mortensen, seemingly just outside the box, but a spot kick was awarded and converted. United goalkeeper Jack Crompton probably should have saved it. Then striker Jack Rowley's deft touch past the goalkeeper allowed him to finish into an empty net to equalise, but Blackpool led again just 7 minutes later. Busby's tactics were cleverly nullifying the threat of Stanley Matthews, but double goal scorer Stan Mortensen was thriving. At halftime, Busby adapted slightly and captain Johnny Kerry gave a simple but inspiring team talk. Then Rowley scored his second equaliser, a fantastic header directed back across goal, after which United's force appeared unstoppable. Stan Pearson's excellent right-footed finishing off the left post finally put United ahead, and John Anderson found the top corner with a wonderful long-range effort to seal a victory of simply immense meaning to United and to Manchester and to its people. United had triumphed in the best final yet played on this Wembley turf. Back home in Lancashire, Reds rejoiced just as they did down at the Empire Stadium.
Taking this cup back to Manchester again after a period of 40 years.
Across Britain, young kids listened to United's glory and fell in love. Amongst them were Ashington's Robert Charlton, Collyhurst's Nobby Stiles, and Glasgow's Patrick Crerand. 2 decades on, this trio were involved as once again United donned royal blue at Wembley. This time, they lifted the European Cup. There was some toil to go before then, but the legacy of this Gibson-envisioned, Rocker-found, Crickmer-engineered, Busby-perfected team should never be doubted. Missing from the celebration, sadly, was James Gibson. United's president, now 70, was not well, and doctor's orders kept him at home.
He couldn't go to the cup final because he'd had a stroke. So his wife and he listened to it on the radio.
United celebrated down south before returning to Manchester, where an immense crowd waited. But they were left waiting just a little longer. United's train stopped short, the players disembarked at Wilmslow, and they made their way to Gibson's home in leafy Hale Barnes. The victorious squad gathered on the lawn below Gibson's bedroom, Captain Johnny Kerry the only exception. he and Busby carried the cup upstairs and presented it to a giddy old man who rose from his bed and came to the window. Down on his lawn, he saw what he ambitiously envisaged a decade ago, a victorious Manchester team made up of Manchester players, all his efforts, sacrifices and risks made worthwhile.
The team presented James Gibson with the cup, which was absolutely wonderful. It was a dream come true.
I'm proud of you boys, Gibson said. This is a moment I've been waiting for. The players went upstairs one by one and received warm congratulations and thanks from an elderly, ill man who had achieved what became, as late as his mid-50s, a lifelong ambition. He bid them farewell, and they were soon in Manchester greeted by a tumult of waving arms, hundreds of thousands of people. Once the buzz died down and he had a moment to pause, Walter Krickmer enthusiastically wrote a letter to Gibson which demonstrated his admiration for the boss.
The players, as you know, put up a great show, he said. The crowds in their own way put up even a greater show when we arrived back in Manchester, one which I shall never forget.
But there was something else.
Minced it all without you, sir,
Krickmer said.
The party was not complete.
Just after the winning the FA Cup, of course, there was nowhere they could keep the cup because Old Trafford hadn't been rebuilt properly then. And so therefore, the cup was kept in Eleanor. And I remember as a youngster going with my parents to have lunch at Eleanor. And after lunch, my uncle was in his bedroom in bed because he'd had the stroke. And we went up there. And on the way up, my aunt took us into what was Alan's old bedroom and opened the wardrobe door and took out this thing all wrapped in a cloth and put it on a console table and opened it up, and that was the FA Cup. As a youngster, holding the FA Cup was quite something, I suppose.
Gibson's illness continued, but he persevered. He continued to attend matches at Old Trafford. Nearly blind, he listened to the crowd's reactions to understand what was occurring in front of him. But being at his spiritual home gave him life. That was until another damaging stroke led to his death in September 1951. His 74-year-old wife Lillian inherited her husband's share of 51%. She was, apparently, not permitted a place on United's board due to her gender, but all decisions had to pass through her approval nevertheless. Sadly, James Gibson missed United's first title in 41 years by mere months. In truth, though, it was the end of this team. So brilliant was the behind-the-scenes revolution enacted by Busby and Murphy, building on Gibson, Rocker and Krickmer's work, that these two men could take the 1952 title-winning side and still say, let's rebuild, because they were so convinced by the greatness of what was coming through. And you know the rest. But the 52 title was the culmination of Gibson's ambition. With Krickmer's unparalleled administrative skill, this ambition had been turned into a reality. A Manchester United made of Manchester players, FA Cup winners, and now English champions.
The engine, the machinery, the mechanics of the operation were something that was in Krickmer's head. Vision was in Gibson's head. Development of everything was in Busby's head. But, you know, it needed the three of them to make it work initially. And, you know, it took colossal effort to pull it around from that. The fascinating thing is the vision that others have subsequently bought into. It's pretty amazing that you've got something still exists, still extant, 80 years later that was put into place by those guys then. I mean, pretty amazing that's still, as a philosophy, is so important to who United are, what United are. And the principal idea that Gibson had was that Manchester United were going to be a internationally recognised beacon for Manchester. So they were going to be the club that helped push the city forward. And in many ways, you know, 70 years later, that is precisely what they're still doing.
You've got to remember, James Gibson laid a foundation stone on solid rock. He didn't build it on sand, he built it on rock. And he built a foundation stone that what is there now has been built on. And people forget that he not only put Manchester and Manchester United on the Trafford Manchester map in England, he put it on the world map. Because you go to any part of the world and mention Manchester United, everybody instantly knows all about Manchester United and Old Trafford. And look at the number of overseas people that visit the ground on tours. It's incredible.
You know, people know of Manchester in, Dar es Salaam because of the football club. That's the fact. And Gibson wanted that and saw that as a possibility.
James Gibson, one of the men who made Manchester United. To read his full story, to learn about United before Busby, about the men who instilled the values of youth, courage and success into the world's biggest football club, a quasi-religion, you can read my book, The Men Who Made Manchester United, which came out in October 2023. It was an honour to tell the story of eight incredible, inspiring men. Thank you for listening to episode 8 of United Through Time. Next time you walk towards Old Trafford, if you're lucky enough to do so, when you cross the bridge on Sir Matt Busby Way, the East Stand looming in front of you, take a moment to search for the plaque in dedication to the man who gave Busby the tools to make United the global club it is today, James Gibson. It'll be on your left side as you approach the ground. Thank you to my guests, Alan Embling, Tony Park and Jim White, all of whom gave me a great deal of their time to talk. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you might enjoy The Men Who Made Manchester United, available to order now.